What can I say? Finally, we are here.
And he might be one of the few to see the Olympics live in Tokyo. This is Friday, the 9th of July, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, the latest on Afghanistan. A UN investigator calls for coordinated action to stem abuse by Myanmar's military leaders. South Korea's capital is on the verge of perhaps its most intense lockdown. More information is revealed about the COVID virus, and the search for the U.S. Capitol attackers is still underway. It is all on today's VOA Asia. International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach arrived in Tokyo Thursday with just over 2 weeks to go before the opening of the Summer Olympics. He sounded as though he might have had an idea what was going to happen.
And I was longing for this day for more than 1 year. And I think we can all be very satisfied that the strict measures having been established to protect everybody, the Japanese people and the participants of the Games, that all these strict measures have proven to be successful and will support any measure which is necessary to have safe and secure Olympic and Paralympic Games for the Japanese people and all the participants.
What did happen later in the day was Olympic and Japanese government officials announcing the Tokyo Olympic Games, scheduled to begin July 23rd, would be held without spectators in Tokyo. Japanese Olympic officials said they made the announcement following consultations with the government and the International Olympic Committee officials. It came hours after Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga went on national television to declare a new state of emergency for Tokyo due to the rise of COVID-19 cases in the capital city. Suga said the new decree will take effect July 12th and last until the 22nd of August, a period that will cover the duration of the Tokyo Olympic Games, which take place July 23rd through August 8th. Foreign spectators had already been banned from attending the Olympics. Tokyo and several other prefectures shifted last month from a state of emergency imposed in April into quasi-emergency measures that are set to expire Sunday, July 11th. However, Japan is coping with a fourth wave of new infections and a slow vaccination campaign that has left just 15% of all Japanese citizens fully inoculated. Tokyo reported 920 new infections Wednesday, its highest numbers since May. The increase has already affected two traditional Olympic events. Tokyo's metropolitan government announced Wednesday that it will move the iconic Olympic torch rally off the city's public roads. Relay runners will instead carry the torch out of public view to private torch lighting ceremonies across Tokyo after the Olympic symbol arrives Friday. In addition, Olympic organizers will request that the public not gather on the streets to witness the marathon races when they're staged in the final days of the Games. The Tokyo Olympics are set to take place after a one-year postponement as the coronavirus pandemic began spreading across the globe. The current surge prompted staunch public opposition against going through with the Olympics, including a prominent group of medical professionals that urged Suga to call off the Games. You're invited to read more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at VOAnews.com. Analysts say North Korea's reshuffle signals military policy not a top priority now. Chinese social media giant WeChat shuts LGBT accounts. Indonesia and Thailand consider booster shots amid doubts over the Sinovac vaccine. Vietnam's capital Hanoi imposes movement restrictions on Thursday to try to keep at bay an expanding coronavirus outbreak there. And Australia's New South Wales state Thursday reported its biggest daily rise in locally acquired cases of COVID-19 for the year. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the VOAnews.com website. President Joe Biden on Thursday said it's up to the Afghan people alone how they run their country as he announced the U.S. military mission in Afghanistan will end on August 31st, despite new concerns about the possibility of a civil war. Biden said, "We did not go to Afghanistan to nation build." He went on to say it's the right and the responsibility of the Afghan people alone to decide their future and how they want to run their country.
The United States did what we went to do in Afghanistan, to get the terrorists to attack us on 9/11 and deliver justice to Osama bin Laden, and to degrade the terrorist threat to keep Afghanistan from becoming a base from which attacks could be continued against the United States. We achieved those objectives. That's why we went.
Biden delivered his most extensive comments to date about the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan under pressure from critics to give more explanation for his decision to withdraw. Biden also said U.S. plans to move thousands of Afghan interpreters out of the country in anticipation of the end of the U.S. military mission in the country, August 31st. The U.S. last week had abandoned Bagram Air Base, a longtime staging ground for U.S. military operations in the country, effectively ending America's longest war. Instead, the U.S. plans to leave 650 troops in Afghanistan to provide security for the U.S. embassy.
The United States cannot afford to remain tethered to policies, creating a response to a world as it was 20 years ago. We need to meet the threats where they are today. Today, the terrorist threat has metastasized beyond Afghanistan. So, we are repositioning our resources and adapting our counterterrorism posture to meet the threats where they are now, significantly higher in South Asia, the Middle East, and Africa. But make no mistake, our military and intelligence leaders are confident they have the capabilities to protect the homeland and our interests from any resurgent terrorist challenge emerging or emanating from Afghanistan.
Biden's order in April to pull out U.S. forces by September 11th after 20 years of conflict has coincided with major gains by the Islamist militant Taliban movement against overwhelmed Afghan forces after peace talks sputtered. The commander of U.S. troops in Afghanistan, General Austin Miller, warned last week that the country may be headed toward a civil war. Still ahead on VOA Asia, the UN wants international pressure to be built on the Myanmar junta. Happening now in Asia, China is prohibiting construction of the tallest skyscrapers to ensure safety following mounting concerns over the quality of some projects. The outright ban covers buildings that are taller than 500 meters. The local authorities will also need to strictly limit the building of towers that are more than 250 meters tall. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Thank you so much for spending some of your time with us on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. A United Nations investigator is calling for international coordinated action to stem abuse by Myanmar's military leaders against its people. In a report to the UN Human Rights Council, the UN Special Rapporteur lists measures for bringing the country's generals into compliance with international human rights norms. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Human rights investigator Tom Andrews accuses the international community of failing the people of Myanmar. In an impassioned speech to the UN Council, he presented documented evidence of widespread systematic attacks by the military junta against the people of Myanmar. Since the junta's overthrow of the country's democratically elected government 5 months ago, he says military forces have killed about 900 people. He says they have forcibly displaced hundreds of thousands, tortured many, and arbitrarily detained nearly 6,000 people.
Some in Myanmar have lost hope that help from the international community will be forthcoming and have instead sought to defend themselves through the formation of defense forces and acts of sabotage, while some are reportedly targeting suspected junta collaborators and officials. and the junta's pattern of the use of grossly disproportionate force in response will likely lead to an even greater loss of life.
Andrew says the people of Myanmar desperately need the support of the international community to end this nightmare. Yet he says little action has been taken beyond international protestations of condemnation, the imposition of sanctions by some nations, and resolutions by UN bodies. The UN investigator is calling for the establishment of a so-called emergency coalition for the people of Myanmar. The plan proposes a series of 5 key measures he says would impose significant costs on the junta. First and foremost, he asserts cutting off the junta's source of income could reduce its ability to attack its citizens. Therefore, he is calling on nations to impose economic sanctions on Myanmar's oil and gas industry.
Oil and gas sector revenues are a financial lifeline for the junta and are estimated to be close to what is needed for the junta to maintain the security forces that are keeping them in power. They should be stopped. Second, an emergency coalition for the people of Myanmar could outlaw the export of arms to the Myanmar military as called for in last month's General Assembly resolution.
The plan also calls for the pursuit of universal jurisdiction cases and filing charges against Myanmar's senior security officials. Other measures include ensuring that humanitarian aid goes directly to the people of Myanmar and the denial of any claims of legitimacy by the junta, such as the false claim that it is recognized by the United Nations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Myanmar authorities announced stay-at-home measures in parts of commercial capital Yangon as the country reported its highest daily coronavirus caseload in months. From Thursday, a ban on more than one person leaving home for non-medical reasons will apply to 10 Yangon townships, where authorities reported almost 4,000 new cases on Wednesday, compared with fewer than 50 per day in early May. Read and see more on these stories at VOA Asia Facebook.
After you listen to VOA Asia, see it. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free and see us often on VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. Despite Australian lobsters being banned by Chinese authorities, demand for them continues to be strong, with some being smuggled into mainland China, so says the South China Morning Post. All the big stories come your way through the day at VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue on VOA Asia. South Korea's capital, Seoul, is on the verge of perhaps its most intense lockdown yet after a surge of coronavirus cases. It is the latest Asian country to see a coronavirus setback, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
South Korea Thursday reported over 1,200 new infections. That may not sound like a lot, but it's South Korea's largest number of confirmed daily cases since the start of the pandemic. South Korea initially contained the virus. However, it has lagged most other developed countries in acquiring vaccines. Over the past several weeks, restaurants, cafes, and outdoor parks along Seoul's Han River have been more crowded than usual as the government prepared to ease social distancing. Jung Jae-hun, a medical doctor who teaches outside Seoul, says that message may have been premature. People, he says, became less vigilant. As a result, Seoul may soon see its toughest yet restrictions, such as a ban on private gatherings of more than 2 people after 6 p.m. Jung says he supports measures that will continue to minimize South Korea's death toll. The government, however, can't suppress the virus forever. The ultimate solution, he says, is to speed up vaccines. In some ways, South Korea's situation mirrors that of other Asian countries, such as Vietnam, Thailand, and Indonesia, which have seen recent infection spikes after initially controlling the virus. South Korea's outbreak, though, is still mild compared to many other countries. Only about 2,000 South Koreans have died of the virus. compared to 605,000 in the United States and 128,000 in Britain. However, in those countries, the vaccine has been widely available for months. In South Korea, less than 11% of the population has been fully vaccinated. Bill Gallo, BOA News, Seoul.
China is accusing Australia of interfering with its efforts to boost the COVID-19 vaccine program in Papua New Guinea. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has that story.
Chinese state-owned media has claimed that Australian consultants in Papua New Guinea have been hindering the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines flown in from China. It was alleged that they'd engaged in political manipulation and bullying there. Australia has strongly denied claims. It's tried to sabotage China's efforts to boost vaccinations in Papua New Guinea. Papua New Guinea is currently using the AstraZeneca vaccine. 200,000 doses of the Sinopharm vaccine have recently been flown in from China, but have yet to be approved for use by local authorities. A Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson warned Australia to stop interfering with and undermining vaccine cooperation between China and Pacific Island countries. Australia's Minister for the Pacific, Zed Seselja, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation all international assistance is welcome.
When it comes to the rollout, what we're focused on is just making sure that we are providing as much assistance as we possibly can. If other countries want to provide assistance, that's wonderful.
Papua New Guinea is Australia's nearest neighbour and has recorded more than 17,000 coronavirus infections and 174 deaths since the pandemic began. But it's hard to get accurate figures due to lack of testing, according to media reports. The South Pacific nation has a population of about 9 million. It's administered just under 55,000 vaccine doses, faced with both hesitancy among Papua New Guineans and a lack of supply. Australia has pledged to ship 10,000 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine to Papua New Guinea every week, along with medical support. It's also promised to donate tens of thousands of additional doses to other Pacific nations. China delivered 50,000 Sinopharm doses to the Solomon Islands earlier this year. The row over vaccines in Papua New Guinea is the latest dispute between Australia and China. Relations have soured in recent years over geopolitical flashpoints, including Beijing's military ambitions in the South China Sea and allegations of Chinese interference in Australia's domestic affairs. Papua New Guinean health officials are trying to stay out of any diplomatic arguments between Australia and China. They've said they're not concerned about where their coronavirus vaccines come from, but just want sufficient supplies to protect the country's population. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Making headlines in Asia, the United Nations nuclear watchdog said it's reached an agreement with Japan on helping monitor and review the release of treated radioactive water from the wrecked Fukushima plant into the Pacific Ocean. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, since the outbreak of COVID-19 started in 2019, we've learned a lot about the virus, who's most vulnerable, how to better treat COVID-19 patients, and how the virus works. Researchers are also discovering how the virus manipulates the body's immune system and evades its defenses, as we learn in this report from VOA's Carol Pearson.
When a virus invades the body, the immune system immediately launches an attack. But COVID-19 seems to be able to fool our immune systems. Michaela Gack is the scientific director and chair of Cleveland Clinic's Innovation and Research Center in Florida. She likens the immune system to a home alarm system that a burglar disables.
Basically, the invader, in this case, the COVID-19 virus, disables the alarm system in the house and thereby can freely, you know, replicate in the human body and spread.
Gack says this happens almost immediately after infection.
Another key feature of this virus is that it can escape the human immune response. This high transmissibility of the virus combined with that it can evade antibody responses really makes it quite alarming.
What makes the virus even more alarming is its more contagious and more serious Delta variant, which is spreading quickly around the world. The Delta variant has become the dominant strain in the U.S. In her lab, Gack's team is studying COVID-19's evasion technique, which she says appears to be unique. She says the technique provides clues for developing medication to fight it.
Targeting this enzyme of COVID-19 of the virus would actually, on the one hand, directly block the virus, but it would also restore or even boost our immune system. So it would have this dual function, what I believe could be very beneficial in terms of therapeutics.
Gack and her team are working with other researchers at several other labs. If successful, they might come up with new ways to treat patients with COVID-19, as well as those infected with another coronavirus, or they might discover new treatments for those suffering from other diseases that start with a virus, such as some cancers. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
The hunt for capital attackers is still on. Associated Press correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
6 months after the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, the FBI continues to hunt for scores of rioters. More than 500 people have already been arrested. On Tuesday, the FBI released 11 new videos of rioters attacking law enforcement officers. The FBI is appealing for the public's help in identifying the suspects. The FBI website includes more than 900 photos of roughly 300 people labeled unidentified, and the FBI is offering a reward of up to $100,000 for information leading to the arrest of the person responsible for planting pipe bombs outside the offices of the Republican and Democratic National Committees on the night before the riot. Mike Gracia, Washington.
North India's Kullu district is famed for its ancient tradition of spinning hand-woven stoles and shawls with designs that have been passed down for generations. Now artisans, many of them women, are learning to make another traditional Indian garment called the sari, under a program sponsored by the local government and private sector that aims to reach new markets and enhance income opportunities for women. The report from Anjana Prasricha.
These artisans deftly weave traditional designs into the woolen fabric that they spin on looms at a workshop in North India's Kullu region. In addition to the traditional shawls made for decades, they are weaving another popular garment worn by women in India and other South Asian countries, the sari.
So to give it a variety and a new twist, we introduced this fabric which is called sari, and I'm very hopeful that the tourist who is coming to this district will definitely take it as a souvenir.
They will be among the first woolen saris, which are usually made of cotton and silk. Authorities are optimistic that adding them to shop shelves will boost income opportunities in this hilly district for artisans, especially women, who have woven garments with ethnic Kullu designs for centuries in their homes.
This work is very good for women. With the income, we can educate our children and live well.
Demand for hand-woven garments, often made from local yarn, has risen in recent decades, according to a manufacturer.
Handloom fabrics have more warmth because they are uneven. Fabric made on power looms cloth does not have gaps, so it cannot trap body heat.
Enhancing the appeal of garments to a more fashion-conscious public has also helped boost sales.
To keep pace with the times and increase sales, we have consulted fashion institutes and started following global fashion forecasting trends.
The artisans have adapted to a new format quickly.
They are expert in making motifs on the fabric, so we just have to train them about the particular width and length of the sari, plus the weight of the sari. It should not be very heavy, because otherwise it will be very uncomfortable to wear.
While an ancient tradition is getting a new spin, much will depend on luring young people to learn the painstaking art. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Thank you for being with us, and thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Chris Casquejo, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, Amy Heibels, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. Enjoy the day ahead.